The plan was to cast Sophia Loren as Caterina and Marcello Mastroianni as Petruchio, but Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton assumed those roles.
Good morrow, Kate. That's your name, I hear.
Well, have you heard? But something hard of hearing. They call me Catherine, that do talk of me.
You lie, Faith, for you were called plain Kate and Bonnie Kate, and sometimes Kate the Cursed. But Kate, the prettiest Kate in Christendom, Kate of Kate Hall, my super dainty Kate, for dainties are all Kates, and therefore, Kate, take this of me, Kate of my consolation. Hearing thy mildness praised in every fashion, thy virtue spoken of and thy beauty sounded, yet not so deeply as thou dost deserve, myself am moved to woo thee for my wife.
Moved? In good time.
Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton in the lead roles in Franco Zeffirelli's film version of The Taming of the Shrew. We're told Zeffirelli took vast liberties with both screenplay and stage direction, ultimately violating what many see as the subtleties of Shakespeare's conception of Kate and Petruchio's co-partnership, setting an irreconcilably abrasive Kate against a swaggering and abusive Petruchio. It seems Taylor and Burton's highly publicized, characteristically volatile marriage permeated their roles as well. An article published in Life magazine in February 1967 illustrates the extent to which Elizabeth Taylor was a construction of what is called the male gaze and exploited by her husband's vision of her. While her image adorns the cover of the magazine and is featured in various shrewish and seductive poses throughout the six-page layout, her voice is poignantly absent. In the accompanying article titled His Liz, a Scheming Charmer, Richard Burton observes, "I first met Elizabeth when she was 19. I thought she was the most beautiful and sullen creature I had ever met. Difficult, unreachable, unmanageable, unattainable, impenetrable, and again, difficult. Now, at age 34, she is an extremely beautiful woman, lavishly endowed by nature, with but a few flaws in the masterpiece." Elizabeth Taylor is viewed through Burton's critical eye. His entitlement to grade her appearance is followed by equally demeaning observations about her intellect, as well as astonishment when she exhibits individuality. With a tone that reveals a sense of ownership and paternal condescension toward his wife. As the producer of the film, in addition to playing the leading role, Burton flagrantly capitalizes on her appeal, even admitting to having an inferiority complex about Elizabeth getting $2 million and I only $1 million. His subjective view of Taylor and his gleeful, quote, taming of her motivates his production of the 1967 film, as well as his performance. Unfortunately, this skewed concept of Kate and Petruchio has become the American standard for Shakespeare's classic. Words of Angelina Avedoni, and that's in an essay titled Kate and Petruchio, Co-Heroes in an Alliance for Agency, May 2011. So then, as recently as 2011, we're reminded that such a movie can still mold our understanding of Shakespeare's Taming of the Shrew and perhaps lead people living in a Me Too world to write off the play as not just dated, but demeaning and even destructive in a certain way. But many devotees of Shakespeare don't see it that way at all. Gaslight Theatre is tackling Taming of the Shrew and exploring the light that current issues can shed on Shakespeare and Shakespeare can shed in our day. The production opens June 22nd at the East End Center in Wilkes-Barre and runs weekends through June 30th, directed by Brandy George and Dave Reynolds. Molly Dooley, who has the role of Kate, and Mike Little, who plays her father, Baptista, and co-director Dave Reynolds, stopped in at the WVIA studios to talk with us about their take on Taming of the Shrew and about Gaslight's roots in Shakespeare, Dave Reynolds.
Gaslight started in 2003 from what we saw to be a need to have classical theater in the community. We opened with a production of Midsummer Night's Dream, followed it up with some Molière, things that aren't done so much. And then, you know, as we continued, we kept our classical roots, but we sort of expanded into doing a lot more original works and things like that. We sort of adapted the mission. But this year, the board discussed we really wanted to get back to kind of our roots of Shakespeare. So the upcoming season, we're jokingly calling the Year of the Spear. So it's all, other than our playroom, which is our original one acts, it's all going to be Shakespeare plays or Shakespeare sort of themed plays. So we can't officially announce yet, but it'll all have something to do with Shakespeare. So Taming of the Shrew is kind of like the end of this season, but kicking off our new season too. So we're really happy to be back at Shakespeare.
Were you choosing Taming of the Shrew consciously in the midst of what's unfolding now, or was the decision made before the news was filled with these issues, gender issues?
I think we absolutely picked it to sort of speak to what's going on now. It's one of the things we're trying to do with this production. It's one of his best comedies. I think it's one of the funniest, zaniest comedies, but I think in the current climate, there's really something that we can say about, you know, equality and some of the themes that the play hints at, so... I think we can talk about that a lot. We talked about, you know, the Me Too movement is something that's, honestly, it's very prevalent right now. And this play could certainly be very misogynistic if that's the way you chose to take it. But we've been really playing, and I'll let Molly talk too. She's playing Katrina. We've been playing with the idea of who's taming who. And that is anyone really being tamed. And it's not so one-sided that Petruchio is taming Katrina, that they're sort of both finding the best and worst of each other and kind of finding something that they love.
Well, certainly we wanted to give her a little bit more, Dave used the word agency, some more power, more of an equal footing with Petruchio. Because certainly the play is a product of its time period. I mean, in the Elizabethan era, men typically held the purse strings and had all the power. So, of course, you run into that challenge when you put it in a more modern context of how do we make this palatable to a modern audience. So that's been my challenge, is using Shakespeare's lines as written, but how do I give her a little bit more control over the situation, or I'll say some control over what's happening to her? She doesn't have a lot, but she certainly stands up for herself. And I think a lot of it comes from Dane Bower, who's playing opposite me as Petruchio. Like he and I have a good rapport, and everything has been decided in concert with each other and with the directors. So we make sure that all the characters are kind of on equal footing and that their sparring never goes too far in one direction, that they're both meeting in the middle.
And that there's something about the wordplay and the banter that attracts them to each other. We talked early on, I didn't want to believe, and I still don't believe, that William Shakespeare wrote a misogynistic play. I mean, I think Sean McEwen, who's playing Grumio, said, it was a great quote, the playwright that wrote Beatrice and Rosalind is not a misogynist. And so I think it's pretty clear that what he's doing here, and I had a discussion with Dr. Megan Lloyd, who teaches at King's, and she's our Shakespeare scholar, and she said, you know, prior to this period, the way that they would tame a shrew would be by putting them in the stocks, like in the pillory, and physical torture. And so Shakespeare is almost saying with this play, here's a better way to do this. And in today's modern context, it's sort of, so it's a little bit rough the way that Petruchio deals with Katrina, but if you look at the fact that he was being progressive for his time, I think it's an easy way to jump into this, what we're trying to do with this, and playing that they both have agency in the story.
And Mike, how are you coming to making sense of these themes for us today?
I think pretty much on the same plane that they're on. One of the things that I think about when I think about Shakespeare is that he is a product of his time. He is writing to audiences with certain expectations, but it's almost as if he cannot contain himself and his own impulses. And so he traffics in stereotypes. You think about Merchant of Venice, for example, but he is never constrained by them. He's never confined by them. He cannot help himself, I think, but see the humanity in all of his characters. And so that's one of the things that punches through for me, even in an early play like this, is his inability to help himself see his characters as the people that they are. And so you can play with stereotypes, you can have some fun with them, you can even go ahead and trot them out for your audience because your audience is expecting them and is going to laugh at them or whatever. But I wouldn't go so far as to say that he has an explicit agenda other than his own, like I say, his own kind of boundless creativity, his boundless humanity.
You mentioned, Dave, the importance of language always to Shakespeare, but in this case, the appeal between you and Petruchio, and you mentioned it, that the language is so important in this particular relationship then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have gone through, myself and Brandy George, the other director, and Molly and Dane, and sort of mined the text and found moments where Petruchio's being genuinely sweet to Kate. He's saying nice things, right? And Kate sees that. And then he goes right back to, you know, if I say it's the sun, if I say it's the moon, but then there's sort of this, they really like each other. I think for Petruchio, he likes her because she's a challenge, and all the other suitors that have come in, she's just shut down immediately. And I think she likes him because he stands up to her. And finding that in the language, those moments where it's not just played for the man's in charge kind of thing, I think has been really interesting and challenging.
For Katerina, her only weapon is language. That's the only thing that she can use against anyone. So Petruchio comes in and he uses that against her. He turns her one weapon, her words, right against her. And when she says, the sun is shining, he forces her to say, no, the moon is shining. And so it's the one thing that he can use against her. And that becomes the basis of their courtship, is they're the arguing and the bickering back and forth and who's right and who's wrong. And then the sweet sort of connection comes out of that. But that primarily is why Kate's a shrew. You know, people shut her down as soon as she starts to talk because she's too free-spirited or too open in society. And then as soon as she opens her mouth to say something, the men are saying, oh, okay, shut her up, please. We don't want to talk to her. But Petruchio gives her that avenue to speak. All of her monologues are prompted by his behavior or encouraged by him. He says, Kate, get up and tell people what you think. And I think that's incredibly powerful for her, is that she's finally given a medium in which she can communicate. And there's somebody who wants to listen to her.
Mike, you were nodding that rings true, right?
That rings very true for me. One of the ways that I think about the play when I read it is that Petruchio, genuinely attracted to her, is seeing someone. He's very clever. He's very smart. And he sees someone with whom he can banter, with whom he can trade wits, someone on a level with him. And he sees her, the way I read this, as trapped in a system that she can't find a way out of. And her way out is to be kind of nasty. And I see him as saying, you're right, your emotional response to the system is the correct one. But the way you're responding is not going to get you out of it. It's not going to help you. Let's negotiate another path out of this.
And there's that great scene. I hadn't thought about it this way, but the scene where Petruchio comes for the wedding and he's dressed in his motley crazy outfit and stuff. And I'd always thought, oh, that's just funny and goofy. And but, you know, Mike said, no, that's him physically rebelling against the system. That's him showing Kate, I don't believe in any of this stuff either. I'm supposed to dress the way I'm supposed to dress, and I'm supposed to be regal and all this stuff, but I'm going to come looking like a lunatic. And that's for her as much as it is for him, right? It's not just to, there'd be no reason for him to do that. He's already won her, you know, he's already paid the dowry. So I think that's a really cool insight that you had. So kudos, Mike, on that one.
Thank you.
Is there a sense in Shakespeare's day that wit as a rhetorical device is something that is especially valued?
Sure, I mean, absolutely, I think. And one of the things I think also rings true here within Shakespeare is that oftentimes the wittiest characters are the fools, right? So in this one, we've got Grumio, who's just Petruchio's man, but he's got some of the wittiest dialogue. And it's that wordplay back and forth. And he has great scenes with Katrina because she has great wordplay. And yeah, I think there is that sort of, you know, the play opens with Lucentio coming to study and to take in the culture. And so, yeah, I think there is this sort of like high-born people spending their time developing their knowledge. And I think that became sort of like bragging rights. And I think that's kind of in this play, too. There's a great sort of like at each other between Hortensio and Lucentio and Tranio, who's impersonating Lucentio and all these wonderful things. And it's just sort of these highborn men doing this stuff. And then I think at the end, the joke's all on them, which is kind of one of the best plot devices in the play.
And I think if you know anything about Shakespeare and his love of wordplay and his wit, you wouldn't believe that he supports the misogynistic view. Because Shakespeare loves words, so why would he make one of the wittiest characters in the play female if he wanted her to be beaten down? She's one of his favorite characters, I would imagine, because she's probably a lot like him, as well as Petruchio and Grumio. So why would he advocate for a character he admires being mistreated? I don't think Shakespeare's misogynistic. I think the fact that he has misogyny in his plays doesn't mean that he's advocating for it. I think he's he's shining a mm-hmm. light on Absolutely. The human condition and showing people this exists. You know, to take it as you will, form your own opinions, but just the fact that it's in his play doesn't mean that he supports it.
And perhaps that's one of the reasons why it works so well right now in a modern context.
Mike, tell us about your role in this.
In the play, I am Baptista. I am Katerina's father. And Baptista's character, there is not much that's fleshed out to this character. And I am approaching him as someone who is really just kind of tired because his daughter is...
smarter than he is.
Oh, absolutely, she's smarter. Because, well, she and Petruchio are far and away the smartest characters in the play, and I think Rumio is a close second. So she is smarter. I don't know how much Baptista would acknowledge that, although I think he would have to kind of know it. But he has a responsibility to both of his daughters, and he has a responsibility to see them married and see them married well. And from that perspective, Katerina is frustrating to him, right? He has a responsibility to her, and she's not helping him meet that responsibility. And so he's just simply tired. I keep using the word, but he's just kind of beaten down a little bit, and he would just like for this to be resolved.
Right. He's seen suitor after suitor after suitor going for Bianca, the younger daughter, and can't do anything about that because Katrina's in the way. So yeah, beaten down by life.
Do you grow by the end?
No.
No.
No, I don't see growth. I might even see regression because by the end of the play, we are at a wedding feast and the men don't comport themselves well in that feast. And he's right there with him.
I mean, except for Petruchio, which is the joy of the play. Like the character arc of both Catherine and Petruchio, I think is wonderful.
What about the relationship between the sisters? What do we learn about female-female relationships?
They're not great in this play. And I think that's deliberate on Shakespeare's part. I mean, he's written some really fantastic female-female relationships. So I think it's a choice to put the two sisters at odds. In many ways, Kate is at odds with everyone in the play. You know, she's not letting her father marry her off, and she's staying where she is out of spite, probably a little bit. But also, there's no great love between the sisters either. So there's no sisterly affection to prompt Kate to let herself be married off so her sister can be happy. There's a scene where we argue with each other, and I physically tie up my sister to hold her in place so I can question her. And I mean, that's the kind of relationship they have. She plays the victim. You know, when Dad walks in, she starts sobbing that her sister hurt her, and I'm not even touching her. There's a lot of fun with playing up that adversarial aspect of it. I know I have a sister, and it feels very true to life for me.
What a well-drawn sibling relationship that he created.
Yes, yeah. And it's been a lot of fun working with Ayanna Groover. She's a joy to work with, and she just inspires me to keep finding new and new ways to antagonize her, and she pokes me right back, and then Mike just sits there and watches his two girls fighting all the time.
Well, I think Baptista has been duped like the other men into thinking that Bianca is something that she is not. You can read the play as if she reveals herself after she's been married as not entirely pleasant, but she has been playing the role of the beautiful, wonderful, perfect daughter all this time. Whereas Katerina has just simply been true all this time. And Baptista doesn't see that any more than anyone else does.
What do you hear? Is there something about this society that is sonically, metaphorically conveyed to us in any way?
We've been trying to do something kind of interesting with this, was that Brandy and myself have tried to do everything together. Like, you know, equality, right? We're doing this together. It's a man and a woman. We can both do it. There's no reason why one can do it better than the other. And so we sort of landed on this concept design-wise that we wanted to make it very much Elizabethan in the sense that there would be costume pieces that would look Elizabethan, but then also bring it into the modern world. So someone will be wearing a hat or a corset, but then they'll be wearing Chuck Taylor sneakers, right? So we were looking for ways to bridge that gap. And so I think what we've landed on is a lot of like classical arrangements of modern music. And so trying to find sort of tongue-in-cheek, now let's play a Beatles song on a lute kind of stuff, which I think has worked really, really well. Sean McEwen, who you know, he and I go back and forth about whether or not you can move Shakespeare to different time periods. I think you can. But I think this one lives really, really well in the time period that it's in. But I also think that subtle reminders of it's timeless work really, really well. So scenically, it's on a straight up as traditional as we can go thrust stage in a retail space with 9-foot ceilings. which is tough. But that's, I think, been a really unique challenge for a lot of the actors. And I was talking to Molly the other day. I take for granted, because, you know, I come from Kings, that we just have this thrust stage we work on all the time. But a lot of people haven't. And so that's different for an actor to work on that stage than a proscenium stage. It's very, very different. But I think once you get it, it's very freeing.
Yeah. Well, being on a proscenium, you're taught to face at a certain angle so that the most audience can see you. But you can't do that in a thrust where the audience is on three sides. So you have to reconcile yourself very early to the fact that someone is always going to be seeing your back, which in a proscenium setup is a big no-no. And so that led to a lot of actors constantly moving around the stage. And there were a lot of actors on the stage, and we're bumping into each other, and we're spinning in place. And Dave had to tell us, please stop moving. It's okay. If they can't see your face, they can see someone else's face, and that's okay. So it was a lot of just getting out of your head a little bit about it and retraining your body to face certain directions. And it's also fun because, especially in Shakespeare, you can talk to the audience more. Even if you don't have a soliloquy that's traditionally directed to the audience, you can still direct your asides, you know, some of your one-off lines. You can engage them. And that works in a three-quarter thrust. It helps you stay visible to your audience, but also keeps you moving a little bit.
Yeah, I said to Molly after our conversation about the thrust the other day that, like, I just never want to see Shakespeare done on a proscenium stage. That's just me personally. But I think the ability to do exactly what you talked about, which is engage with the audience, turn to the audience. You make the audience a character in the show. You bring them into the world. And I think that gets very much lost when you're up on a proscenium behind that fourth wall. So I think maybe it's unique to the area to have a stage like this for a Shakespeare play. And I think Shakespeare intended it to be done this way, right? This is what the globe looked like. You're right there. You're leaning down, talking to people. So I think that's kind of cool.
Are you finding that too, Mike?
I've been on a few of these thrust stages. It takes some getting used to. I think inevitably at some point your back will be to someone. And so at that point, there's nothing you can do about you, but you can do the best that you can to make sure they can at least see the other people, the people you're talking to. And so that's more what I'm thinking about, just acknowledging that there will be times people will see your back. And so just make sure you're not blocking them from the other people.
And it requires you to use your voice in a different way than the proscenium stage, right? You know, you have to project. You know, if they can't see you, then they've got to hear you, right? So it's sort of like a whole new way to learn to act. So, and you guys are doing great.
You mentioned the banquet and the ending. We know traditionally in the comedies that for Shakespeare, that is symbolic of a communal reconciliation and so forth. Do we feel comfortable? Are all the loose ends tied up at the end, or do you pull some threads?
We pull some threads. I don't want to say too much, but we're not changing anything. Everything is there. But I think there's been a real strong idea that maybe Catherine and Petruchio are, I don't know how to say it without giving it away. They're kind of in cahoots with a lot of stuff.
Well, you've got two of the smartest people in the play, and they recognize the situation, and, you know, Katerina recognizes that she's not happy at home, and it's a Shakespeare play. It's a comedy. You have to end with a wedding. You have to end with a party. And I think all the characters find themselves in the place where they wanted to be at the beginning of the play, but they're slowly realizing that this isn't the best place for them. It's what they wanted, but they're not appreciative of getting it.
Yeah, so I think what I'll say is, I'm paraphrasing, but the last line is Lucentio's, and it's a wonder that thou hast tamed such a shrew, or something like that. And we make that a question. And then there might be a little bit more information that the audience gets after that line, which I think sort of ties into our idea that, like Molly said, these are the two smartest characters. They are miles ahead of everyone else with what they're thinking, what they're doing, and knowing how to manipulate situations, I think.
And so audiences who are seeing what you're doing in this production, we might in fact feel the timeliness of it and suggest that though our society is not Shakespeare's Elizabethan times, we know about strictures in society, and we know that people have to negotiate when they're in a workplace or wherever they are, and they have to make decisions on how to cope with it in certain ways.
Absolutely. I think most modern audiences watching this show will see situations that they recognize, personalities that they've interacted with. I mean, certainly from a female perspective, I mean, the women are completely outnumbered. There are three female characters, and how many men?
Many more than that.
A lot. So, I mean, already they're outnumbered. And if you take that situation, you put it in the workforce, you get the same idea. Women are outnumbered. So I think it's very true to life in that regard. And definitely, even in 2018, you know, you're still finding these Elizabethan ideas. They may have been filtered a little bit, but we're still experiencing that even now. You know, women being told to be quiet, being put down, the male camaraderie in the male scenes, you know, where they're competitive and they're trying to one-up each other. I mean, people still do that. Men and women still do that. So that adds to the timelessness of Shakespeare, is that he was a very, very accurate portrayal of human, of Elizabethan humanity, and it really doesn't get outdated.
Molly Dooley, who has the role of Kate, Mike Little, who plays her father, Baptista, and co-director, Dave Reynolds, speaking with us about the Gaslight Theater production of Shakespeare's Taming of the Shrew, opening June 22nd at the East End Center in Wilkes-Barre, running weekends through June 30th, co-directed by Brandy George and Dave Reynolds. The shows are Fridays and Saturdays at 8 with a Sunday matinee as well. And for more information on the web, gaslight-theater.org. That's June 22nd, 23rd, 29th, and 30th at 8 p.m. and June 24th, the Sunday matinee, at 3. For more information on the web, gaslight-theater.org, and theater is T-H-E-A-T-R-E. The Taming of the Shrew, presented by Gaslight Theater, June 22nd, 23rd and 24th, 29th and 30th, at the East End Center in Wilkes-Barre. For more information on the web, gaslight-theater.org.